Welcome back to The Truth About the Market, where we cut through the noise and talk about what's really happening in aviation. Not the hype, not the headlines, but the truth. I'm your host, Jason Zilberbrand. I'm president of VREF. Over my career, I have appraised just about everything that flies, from Pipers to Gulfstreams, for clients that range from the FAA and SpaceX to celebrities, billionaires, global financial institutions, and some of the largest aircraft fleets in the world. I've also owned, operated, bought, and sold my own aircraft, so I understand these issues not just academically, but operationally and financially. And just as important, this podcast is sponsor-free. There are no paid opinions. There are no advertisers to appease and no incentive to soften reality. What you hear is unfiltered because aviation doesn't reward spin and markets punish misinformation. Today's episode is a little different, but it still sits at the intersection of everything we talk about on this show: asset values, capital markets, institutional trust, and what happens when financial systems fracture. Because if you want to understand Bitcoin, folks, not the price, not the headlines, you have to go back to 2008, not as a chart, but as a psychological breaking point in modern finance. See, 2008 didn't just break banks. It broke trust. And not in a single institution, but in the architecture of financial system itself. Trust in rating agencies that stamp complex securities as low risk, and trust in regulators tasked with monitoring leverage, and trust in institutions assumed to understand the exposures they were underwriting. And most importantly, trust in the system's ability to measure, distribute, and contain risk. To understand how deep that fracture ran, you have to look beyond housing and equities and into capital-intensive collateral markets like aviation. Because aviation doesn't move on sentiment. It moves on confidence. Aircraft don't transact on impulse. They trade on financing structures and lease underwriting and residual value forecasts and lender appetite. And every transaction rests on capital availability and the belief that credit risk is quantifiable and manageable. And when that belief is intact, markets function efficiently, with liquidity flows and financing clears and transactions closing with predictable friction. But when the confidence weakens, aviation feels it immediately. And in late 2008, aircraft markets didn't just gradually slow. They stalled completely. Financing evaporated, credit committees froze exposure, approved loans were withdrawn, deals approaching closing collapsed under tightening conditions. The aircraft themselves didn't change. Operators still needed a lift, and utilization did not disappear overnight. But what did vanish was the trust in the financial framework that supported ownership. And that distinction is critical. Because aircraft values don't move on utility alone, they move on the strength of the capital system financing them. When interbank confidence deteriorated and lending channels seized, leveraged asset markets, business aviation included, locked in place. While public attention focused on housing foreclosures and equity drawdowns, a parallel shock moved quietly through aircraft portfolios. Transactions completely froze. And refinancing pathways narrowed, if not completely disappeared. And all the residual value assumptions were repriced and thrown out the door. And from that institutional rupture, not technological ambition, Bitcoin emerged. Not as an innovation experiment, but as a reaction to bailouts and liquidity injections and monetary intervention. Because when trust fractures at the institutional level, consequences don't remain contained. They spread across markets and across collateral systems. And sometimes they give rise to entirely new financial constructs. So rewind the core mechanics of 2008. The global financial system didn't simply enter a recession. It exposed structural fragility that had been building for years beneath the surface of modern credit markets. Major banks failed outright. Others were forced into emergency mergers. Several survived only through extraordinary government support. Institutions long viewed as pillars of stability suddenly depended on external rescue to remain solvent. At the center of the crisis sat structured credit, layered, securitized, and distributed so broadly that true risk concentration became obscured. Mortgage-backed securities, once treated as ultra-safe, deteriorated rapidly. Instruments stamped AAA, widely held by pensions and insurers and sovereign funds, repriced as distressed exposure in a matter of months. Liquidity didn't just gradually tighten, it completely locked up. and that interbank lending spreads widened as counterparties began questioning each other's solvency. The funding markets, the transmission mechanism of global finance became so impaired. But the most lasting damage wasn't the balance sheet lost. It was intellectual, because market participants realized multiple safeguards had failed simultaneously. Those risk models collapsed under real stress, and the leverage existed off balance sheet, and the ratings were shaped by conflicted incentives, and regulation lagged financial innovation. Institutions designed to disperse risk had, in practice, concentrated it. So, when failure became unavoidable, government intervention focused on stabilizing the financial framework and capital injections and asset purchase programs and emergency liquidity facilities. The objective wasn't to prevent all these losses. It was to prevent systemic collapse. That distinction mattered because it forced markets to confront uncomfortable questions. What happens if major banks require sovereign rescue? What if monetary supply can't expand during crisis? What if private risk can't mitigate onto public balance sheets? Then how stable is a system governing value itself? Because 2008 just didn't damage markets. It permanently altered how institutional trust was measured. In 2009, something emerged quietly. It wasn't launched by a central bank, and it wasn't introduced through policy reform, and it didn't originate in venture capital ecosystems. It began with a white paper published under the name Satoshi Nakamoto, an identity that remains unknown today. The premise was radical in its simplicity. A financial system capable of operating without a central authority. There would be no central bank adjusting the supply, no policy body manipulating the rates, and no institution capable of expanding liquidity during crisis. Instead, Bitcoin proposed a rules-based monetary network, enforced by software, and validated through distributed consensus rather than regulatory oversight. When the Genesis block was mined, Satoshi embedded a newspaper headline referencing bank bailouts underway at the time. It was deliberate. Bitcoin wasn't born from technological optimism. It was born from institutional distrust. Its design principles reflected that origin. It had a fixed supply capped at 20 million coins that are transparent. There's no centralized settlement counterparty, and it's direct peer-to-peer transfer. No discretionary intervention, no emergency liquidity facilities, no monetary expansion mechanisms. It attempted to replace institutional trust with mathematical certainty. And, you know, from an aviation finance perspective, this is where the framework shifts become relevant. Because historically, scarcity has always been physical. Aircraft require aluminum and engines and avionics, with labor and certification and continuous maintenance. Supply is constrained by production capacity, capital costs, and regulatory approval. Every additional aircraft entering the fleet demands industrial effort, time, and financing. Scarcity is tangible. But Bitcoin introduced digital scarcity, an asset with a provable supply cap but no physical production constraint and no operating utility. And unlike aircraft, it produces no operating cash flow and derives value primarily from perceived scarcity and adoption. Yet, it commands significant market value based on collective belief in its independence from institutional control. And that's where systemic risk transmission begins to form. Because as Bitcoin's market value expands, it increasingly intersects with real-world capital markets, investor liquidity and lender collateral frameworks, and high-net-worth portfolios that also finance aviation assets. If volatility destabilizes those capital pools, the transmission doesn't remain digital. It moves into collateral markets, including aircraft, which is why Bitcoin isn't just a technological story. It's becoming a financial stability one, one that aviation as a leveraged collateral asset class can't ignore. This episode is brought to you by VREF, the trusted name in aircraft valuations and appraisals. Whether you fly a piston single or manage a business jet fleet, VREF keeps you grounded in data that matters. Visit VREF.com to know what your aircraft is truly worth before you buy, sell, or finance. So let's consolidate discussion where it actually matters for aviation, and because the ownership demographics and capital volatility are very real. Because aircraft values don't move in isolation. I say that all the time. They move the financial health, liquidity profile, and risk exposure of people buying them. Historically, large cabin aircraft ownership skewed toward industrial wealth, manufacturing founders, energy executives, real estate operators, private equity principals, balance sheets built on operating businesses, contracted cash flow, and hard assets. That capital base, while cyclical, was anchored to functional enterprise value. Today, that demographic is evolving. We're seeing a growing cohort of aircraft buyers whose wealth is tied at least partially to digital assets, things like Bitcoin included. They're crypto founders and token investors. Maybe they're miners or high volatility traders or liquidity event entrepreneurs. And that introduces a fundamentally different risk profile into aviation ownership base because Bitcoin wealth behaves differently than industrial wealth. It expands quickly in bull cycles, creating acquisition liquidity. Aircraft purchases accelerate. Fleet upgrades occur sooner. First-time buyers enter the market. But contraction happens just as fast. Because when Bitcoin corrects sharply, balance sheets compress. Paper wealth is gone. Credit tolerance is gone. Liquidity priorities shift. Aircraft being discretionary high-value assets, well, they often become liquidity release valves. Listed not because utilization dropped, but because portfolio volatility forced a rebalancing of their balance sheets. That's where transmission risk begins to mirror early stage 2008 dynamics. Back then, the trigger asset was housing, but the damage spread through several leveraged financial structures tied to it. Today, Bitcoin isn't systemically embedded at the same scale, but its integration is expanding. And it's expanding into investor net worth statements and into collateralized lending facilities and into liquidity reserves, backing acquisition behavior. And aviation sits downstream of that capital. So volatility in digital assets can translate into increased aircraft listings with accelerated resale cycles and pricing pressure in discretionary segments. And that refinancing stress among leveraged owners is real. This doesn't mean Bitcoin fails. It doesn't mean aviation fundamentals weaken. It just means that ownership liquidity becomes more sensitive to high volatility capital pools. That's the demographic shift lenders and appraisers need to monitor. Because aircraft remain functional assets, governed by maintenance and utility and replacement cost. But when a growing percentage of owners derive wealth from assets priced on sentiment, rather than cash flow, market stability becomes correlated to financial psychology, rather than operating economics. And that's where parallels to pre-2008 fragility begin to surface, not in the aircraft, but in the capital supporting them. Here's the uncomfortable reality, particularly for those of us inside aviation finance and asset-backed lending. 2008 wasn't solved. It was stabilized. The immediate crisis passed, but the structural response reshaped the capital environment aviation still operates within today. Central bank balance sheets expanded and sovereign debt increased, liquidity facilities multiplied, intervention tools became normalized rather than exceptional. From a banking standpoint, the system became more shock resistant, but it also became more policy dependent. And aviation sits directly downstream of that dependency. Post-2008, aircraft financing didn't just replace or reprice risk, it redefined it. With advance rates tightening and residual assumptions becoming way more conservative, exit liquidity became central to underwriting, if not the number one priority. Credit committees, they focus as much on resale markets now as operating cash flow. And even now, aircraft values remain highly sensitive to interest rates and credit availability and capital cost, variables driven as much by monetary policy as aviation fundamentals. So when liquidity expands, aircraft markets strengthen. When liquidity contracts, transaction velocity slows, even if operational demand remains intact. That micro or macro liquidity environment also fueled Bitcoin's rise because it's easy money, abundant capital, and distrust in a fiat system accelerated digital asset adoption. But now, folks, we're entering a more complex phase because Bitcoin wealth is no longer isolated from real assets. And it's completely embedded in ownership demographics. And that's where speculative volatility begins intersecting with aviation collateral. We're seeing high visibility examples of this shift. Speculative investors, traders, and all these digital founders and syndicators, they acquired aircraft during liquidity expansion cycles, often funded by paper gains rather than operating necessity. But when digital markets reverse, Aircraft can become liquidity release valves, as I said. And a recent case in point, Grant Cardone publicly listed his aircraft, a Global 7500, while managing exposure tied to a Bitcoin short position that he had. He put it on X and listed it in Controller. And it wasn't driven by lack of utilization or maintenance timing or a fleet strategy decision. It was purely based on liquidity management. That's a fundamentally different sale trigger than lenders historically modeled. Traditionally, aircraft hit the market due to fleet upgrades or maybe pending maintenance or a partnership change. But now we're going to add a new catalyst, speculative capital stress. And this is where down cycle risk happens. If Bitcoin experiences a severe contraction, particularly alongside tightening credit markets, forced asset sales will accelerate. Not because aviation fundamentals weakened, but because the owner balance sheets did. And aircraft remain functional assets, but ownership liquidity pressure can still distort timing, which will affect your supply levels and pricing behavior. And that's the parallel you have to watch. Because, as I said, systemic risk doesn't originate inside the aircraft, it originates in the capital structure and the speculative exposure supporting the people who own them. So let's talk a little bit about regulation and risk and all this stuff and how it's aviation parallel. Because the next variable in discussion isn't technological, it's jurisdictional. Because digital assets don't operate outside government reach, they operate ahead of it, at least temporarily. And history shows financial innovation is tolerated while it's peripheral, and then it's scrutinized once it intersects with monetary sovereignty and capital markets, or in this case, systemic risk. And Bitcoin is approaching that threshold, not as a payment tool, but as a capital reservoir large enough to influence liquidity flows and tax exposure and collateral structures. And that's where regulatory posture begins to matter, particularly for lenders. If digital assets embed deeper into borrower balance sheets, structural responses are going to follow. And that's going to include expanded tax enforcement and transaction reporting and custody and segregation rules. There's going to be banking access limitations, and there's going to be collateral eligibility determinations. For aviation finance, this isn't abstract, because think about it. If borrower liquidity or net worth or a loan is supported materially to tied to crypto holdings, regulatory treatment directly impacts underwriting confidence. How can you verify a position? Is a bank going to be able to lien this stuff? Can they be liquidated through court process? How can they be taxed upon conversion? See, those answers, that's what's going to influence the credit risk, just as much as aircraft appraisals. And that brings us back to the aviation parallel, because 2008 taught us what happens when risk becomes detached from operating reality, when leverage and modeling and assumptions and structured exposure drift too far from asset fundamentals. Aircraft are operating machines first, financial instruments second. But in a strong liquidity market, that order can invert, because exit liquidity is going to get taken for granted. It feels stable at first until financing tightens, and then operating reality reasserts itself again quickly, and aircraft just don't lose utility. The market simply repriced those assumptions, and that's the lesson. Whether it's structured credit in 2008 or digital collateral today, when valuation frameworks drift too far from tangible fundamentals, gravity isn't theoretical, it's eventual. So I want to close this episode out by grounding everything in what we've discussed: distrust and dislocated markets and liquidity shocks and a real aviation transaction that occurred. Because one critique I hear often is, Jason, you're always so negative on the markets. But understanding risk isn't pessimism. It's preparation. And more importantly, dislocation creates opportunity for those positioned to recognize it. So let me give you an example. Back in 2006, I had the opportunity to acquire a pre-delivery position on a brand new long-range Falcon 7X. Back in those days, I was an active trader. I bought and sold aircraft every day, and I had a credit facility, and I was inventorying other delivery positions. So I knew that business model well. The original buyer, He was a highly visible real estate developer, and he sponsored a bunch of women's PGA and LPGA circuits. And on paper, he appeared to be exceptionally well capitalized, but his balance sheet was heavily leveraged into real estate development projects. And all of those were beginning to strain as the credit markets were starting to tighten, because 08 really started happening in 06. And as liquidity contracted, his capital stack unraveled and all of his projects stalled and his debt started to accumulate. And he got the cash call. And like many overleveraged sponsors during that period, he was forced to liquidate his aircraft position to raise cash. Sound familiar? Well, that's where I stepped in. I acquired the delivery position for approximately $17 million, what he had paid, not what it was worth. My attorney called me with the deal. He said, I have something of an odd one, and the rest is kind of history. At that time, in that stressed environment, the price appeared defensible, even fair as to the bank. I had to borrow the rest to make sure I had the payments covered. But the purchase price wasn't reflective of the forward aircraft demand at the time. It was distressed pricing. I was getting a sweetheart deal that was driven by liquidity pressure, not asset fundamentals. So I held the position. And for a couple weeks, yep, that's right, not one progress payment was made, not one shred of interest was paid to the bank. The buyer was a Russian family who owned a major construction company. They didn't want to get in the back of the line in those days. You could wait 5 years for a brand new long-range aircraft, maybe seven. And they paid a hefty premium to avoid it. The profit approached $30 million. Still to this day, the largest gain I've realized on an inventory aircraft transaction. And it set records. And that's the broader lesson. Because dislocations don't just destroy value, they reprice it. They expose leverage. They create opportunity. They create deals. They force liquidity events. They create entry points invisible during stable cycles. So when I talk about systemic fragility or speculative excess, it's not negativity. It's recognition that havoc and opportunity move together, because the greatest profits in aviation or any asset class are often realized not during stability, but in the aftermath of financial stress. And if you're tired of guessing about aircraft values, try the new VREF Online. Real-time data, quarterly updates, and over 900 models at your fingertips. From residual value forecasts to depreciation trends, it's the platform trusted by every lender, every insurance company, and every broker worldwide. Subscribe today at VREF.com and start making decisions based on facts, not feelings, and please, not AI slop. All right, so that's where I'll leave it. Bitcoin wasn't born out of technological curiosity. It emerged from financial fracture, a response to a systemic distrust at the time of monetary intervention and the realization that institutional stability isn't guaranteed. So whether you see it as digital gold, speculative liquidity, or a geopolitical hedge, its origin is inseparable from the events of 2008. And for those of us in aviation, an industry built on financing, collateral confidence, and long-duration asset risk, the lessons are directly relevant. Trust drives liquidity. Liquidity drives values. And when trust breaks, markets don't just soften, they replace reality, sometimes abruptly. But dislocation doesn't only destroy wealth, it just redistributes it as well. To disciplined buyers, to cycle-aware lenders, to those managing leverage while others are forced to unwind it, that's the constant across every asset class, from digital markets to business jets. Periods of stress expose fragility. They also create opportunity for those who are prepared. Understanding that balance, risk and opportunity, is what keeps you ahead of the market, not reacting to it. If you enjoyed this episode of VREF, The Truth About the Market, I'd appreciate you taking a moment to support the show. Leave us a review, share the episode with a colleague or a client, and follow the podcast so you don't miss upcoming discussions on aviation finance, valuation risk, and the macro forces shaping asset markets. There's no sponsors, there's no ads, just data, experience, and perspective from inside the market. And remember, when you need accurate, defensible, and data-driven aircraft values, there's only one name in the industry to trust, and that's VREF. Visit VREF.com to get started today. Thank you for listening. I'm Jason Zilberbrand, and this is The Truth About the Market. Until next time, fly safe and stay smart.